The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Deficit dissatisfaction, why neither side on the debt ceiling deal came away completely happy, why the market and a key credit rating fell anyway, plus policy and politics going forward.
Iran, threatening and threatened. Tehran still supports terror in the region, but cannot ignore spillover from eruptions in Syria, Libya, and Egypt.
Democracy USA, could an upcoming convention in Wisconsin launch a Tea Party of the Left, and with what impact at the grassroots and beyond?
Security USA, a new administration strategy to stop domestic radicalization, and the latest low-tech twist on airport screening.
Embracing Hazard, the Dukes of Hazard, that is, Tony-nominated actor-singer Tom Wopat on the road from that TV classic to Broadway and a new jazz CD.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated. For Your Ears Only, for the week of August 7th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
I think the big win here for us and for the American people is the fact that there are no tax hikes in this package.
The process was divisive. It was delayed. And if we want our businesses to have the confidence they need to get cash off the sidelines and invest and hire, then we've got to do better than that.
There's certainly signs that the U.S. economy has weakened in recent months. The economy in the first half of the year was pretty soft, and then there are concerns that the problems in Europe could spread over to the United States. So I think investors are rightly worried.
Talk about a Pyrrhic victory, one that costs the winner more than he gains, maybe loss of the war itself. A lack of new revenues in the deficit reduction deal that House Majority Leader Eric Cantor crowed about last week as the price for raising America's debt ceiling was specifically cited by Standard & Poor's in its first ever downgrade of U.S. credit, along with avoiding entitlement reform and the bitter ideological brinksmanship about which President Obama was quick to complain.
Ironically, the European financial problems that helped drive the stock market down dramatically the next day, as noted in an AP interview by Gus Fauché of Moody's Analytics, also continued to make U.S. Treasury bonds seem the safest investment worldwide. That apparently helped Moody's and a third major rating service decide not to downgrade America's credit standing. And it may avoid any significant rise in domestic interest rates for businesses and consumers. There was also modestly better than expected news on the employment front, 117,000 new jobs in July, edging unemployment back down to 9.1%.
But the price to be paid by all the politicians involved in the ugly deficit deal in Congress and the White House may be a major factor come election 2012. To talk about the deal, the downgrade, the policy and political fallout going forward for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Julian Zelizer, Princeton professor of history and public affairs, author of Jimmy Carter, and editor of The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Even before the credit downgrade, polls showed the public blaming Republicans more than Democrats for a dysfunctional debt ceiling deficit cutting process. Do you think the S&P spotlight on lack of additional revenue tips the blame game in Obama's favor, or does he still bear the burden as the man in charge?
I think he still bears the burden as the man in charge. I think come election day, if the economy is like this, if the stock market is still fragile or uncertain, and simply the advertisement about what happened with the S&P and President Obama being the person in office when the credit rating was downgraded, I think that's a powerful argument against the president. And even if it's not his fault, it's going to be tough come election day to counteract some of this.
What impact do you see the downgrade and the specific mention of revenues having on the Congressional Super Committee, charged with presenting another $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions, if Congress doesn't want to see automatic across-the-board cuts?
Well, it certainly puts pressure on Congress to deal with the issue of tax revenue. Republicans have wanted to avoid that. They insisted that has to be off the table. But if they want to take the S&P seriously, now they have to deal with the fact that tax revenue was mentioned in their report. I do think there's going to be a lot of pressure to raise taxes through tax reform. Otherwise, they will never achieve the kind of deficit reduction that the GOP is insisting must happen.
Is that super committee and the automatic spending cut triggers it's working with more evidence of the political dysfunction that led to the S&P downgrade? It's almost like the sheriff in the Mel Brooks comedy Blazing Saddles who holds a gun to his own head to escape a mob.
There is an element of that, and it was remarkable how the S&P focused on the political process rather than the budget itself. And the lack of confidence isn't necessarily in the U.S. economy. It's in the ability of this government to handle economic problems and to deal with each other. So I think the super committee now becomes a test to see if we can handle these difficult decisions, even in the polarized age within which we live.
Of course, this isn't the first time partisanship and ideology have played with the debt ceiling and paralyzed the federal government. How do you compare the latest game of chicken in Washington with the battles of the mid-90s, and what's changed?
I do think that it was more aggressive what we saw from the Republican Party, meaning in 1966, for example, Republicans voted in the House against raising the debt ceiling, but they didn't control the House. It was purely symbolic. It was a way to protest Lyndon Johnson's deficits. This time, it wasn't symbolic. The Republicans controlled the House, and they were willing to allow the U.S. to face the financial consequences of not raising the debt ceiling. They played real hardball with the budget, and I think we've entered a new stage where Republicans, at least, are willing to go very far to get the specific policies they desire.
You've urged Republican leaders to push back more on these Tea Party conservatives, but in a way, didn't Boehner and the Senate Republican leaders sort of sell the Tea Party people a bill of goods, putting their faith in an as-yet-to-be-named committee, these automatic triggers where Congress still can block anything from actually happening?
They do, although there's this trigger where there can be consequences if the committee doesn't reach a deal, meaning defense cuts can be made that will not be palatable to the Republican Party and to many Democrats, and entitlement reform will happen, which Democrats don't want. So it's not simply a committee with a blank check to do whatever it wants, including inaction. There are consequences.
Have American politics become so balkanized that Tea Party conservatives can count on re-election by like-minded constituents, even if their approach on spending and taxes is opposed by a majority of voters?
Oh, absolutely, and that's the process of incumbency. You know, they are running in the primaries of their districts, and for Tea Party Republicans in conservative areas, they come out of this looking like the real zealots, the real believers in the cause. And national polls don't matter in congressional elections. So I think a lot of Tea Party Republicans come out of this just fine. They will be reelected. And that's the dilemma that Republicans who are thinking nationally face. How do you balance the national polls versus the reality that most of them will be reelected?
Were you surprised that so many of the Republican presidential wannabes right now sort of avoided the whole debt ceiling deficit debate until it was, in effect, settled?
Not at all, because they're reading these national polls and they realize this could turn out badly for a Republican presidential candidate. You know, President Obama is not doing well. He's in a precarious political position. His only hope is that Republicans are doing just as poorly and don't have any great candidates. So I think a lot of the Republican presidential candidates just want to stay out of this as much as possible. And they will make statements, which they did, but they don't want to become too invested in this particular debate going into the election.
As a historian of U.S. security policy and politics, were you surprised that the new defense secretary, Leon Panetta, spoke out so strongly against cuts in his budget?
Not that much. I mean, even people who are brought in to cut the budget then start to defend it once they're in charge of a particular agency. And part of this is a game. A lot of what you're hearing right now is preparing for this joint committee. So you want Secretary Panetta to scare the voters, to scare Congress about what cuts would do, with the hope it will increase the pressure on that committee to make a deal. So I assume we're going to hear a lot more of that in the coming months, and some of that is actually in Obama's interest.
Julian Zelizer is a Princeton professor of history and public affairs and author of Jimmy Carter and editor of The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment.
Now this quote from the news, "They carried away parts of their plane and shattered pieces of their bodies." That was a Taliban spokesman after insurgents shot down a NATO helicopter, killing 31 U.S. Special Operations troops and 7 Afghans just west of Kabul, according to President Hamid Karzai and a coalition military official in one early report. The deadliest copter downing in nearly 10 years of war there.
Next, Iran, threatening and threatened. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The liberals will escape or be killed. Libya will look like Saudi Arabia, like Iran. So what? That was Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi, son of Libya's embattled strongman, suggesting that he had begun to form an alliance with radical Islamists against more secular rebels. A top Islamist leader confirmed contact but denied any deal, as did the Qaddafi government. Now this.
Opponents and supporters of Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak clashed last week outside the Cairo courtroom where Mubarak lay on a hospital gurney in the prisoner's cage as his trial began on charges in connection with corruption and the killing of democracy demonstrators whose protests led to his ouster. Meanwhile, opponents of Syria's president Bashar al-Assad took to the streets again in Damascus and other major cities and were cut down by government gunfire in Hama. And disillusion was reportedly spreading in Tunisia, birthplace of what had been called the Middle East Democracy Spring.
All of which is being closely followed by the leaders of Iran, for whom Syria is among its last supporters in the region, and whose great fear is that unrest across the Mideast will reignite popular opposition within Iran's borders. At the same time, U.S. officials say Iran continues to aid and abet anti-Western violence in Afghanistan and Iraq as U.S. forces proceed with scheduled drawdowns. To talk more about Iran, both threatened and threatening, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
How is the bloody protest and pushback in Syria affecting its role as Iran's sole ally in the region?
I think it is making the Iranian leaders very, very nervous. That's why every indication is that they have sent aid in form of Revolutionary Guard commanders, in form of cash, in form of advice, in form of reassurance to make sure that Assad stays and does not go. They have also tried to pressure Turkey to take more neutral role.
How does the unrest throughout the region and the image of an aged, ailing Mubarak on trial in Egypt affect the way Iran's leaders deal with dissent in their own country?
Well, they have a very Soviet-style, era-like reading of history. They pick and choose their facts and ignore what is uncomfortable. They, for example, attack the democratic movement in Syria as something that is created by Israel and the United States. In Egypt, if you read the news from Iran, you would think that the entire Egyptian democratic movement wants nothing but the creation of Islamic State there. So their reading is that this is an Islamic movement in Egypt, and it is an Israeli movement in Syria. And in Bahrain, for example, it is the Shiites who are rebelling against the government. They like that movement, but they don't like what is happening in, for example, Libya. They're concerned that the fall of Syria and Libya will eventually expedite their own fall.
You've written that increasing contention in Iran over Islamic dress code for women may prove a key element in the history of clerical power's rise and eventual fall there. What's happening on that front?
Well, every summer, when the heat gets increased in Tehran, attacks on women also increase. This year, what has been remarkable is that before the beginning of summer, there have been a number of rapes reported, a few gang rapes reported, and the fact that the regime, instead of coming down hard on the rapist, has essentially more than once accused the woman for being raped, accused them of having loose dress and loose demeanor, has antagonized the woman even more. So there is an ongoing battle between the woman and the regime for their ability to dress as they like. The last week, one of the most remarkable things happened in Iran. It's been very little reported in the West, but it's really shaken the regime to the core. People organize on the Facebook that on a certain hour in the day, they would converge in a park and bring guns filled with water and play water games with one another. this water game has now become a major point of contention for the regime. They think Israel and the United States have helped organize this water game movement. But the only simple fact is young men and women playing with water in summer heat in Tehran is the most natural thing one can expect.
Talk about the way Iran's clerical and military leaders also been putting pressure on the country's provocative president, Ahmad Ahmadinejad, to fix him, and why.
Well, Ahmadinejad, by every indication, had begun to begin his own myth that he was, in fact, elected. As you know, there was a contested election in 2009. Every indication is that he lost that election, but it was an electoral coup d'etat by the IRGC. But Ahmadinejad began to act as if he, in fact, did have 24 million votes. He began to defy Khamenei's orders and wishes. He began to fire Khamenei aides and ministers close to Khamenei, and Khamenei decided to teach him a lesson in the hard realities of who really controls the media and who controls the IRGC. And within days, the man who was praised as the most pious president in the history of the Islamic Republic was now being lambasted as a devil worshiper, as someone who conjured Satan, someone who killed cats in mysterious Masonic rites to work and talk with the devil, all kinds of rather strange accusations, and they came very, very close to impeaching him. There are articles of impeachment still at the Majlis pending, standing over his head like the famous sword in case he misbehaves.
We should remind the listeners that Ayatollah Khamenei is the supreme leader, the clerical top dog. But you say that he and other clerical rulers also may feel some pressure from the military, notably the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards.
My sense is that the IRGC is now the top dog, as you would call it, in Iran. I think they control at least 40 to 50% of the economy. The man who was in charge of their biggest construction company, an IRGC company called Qarargah Khatam al-Anbiya, is now the Minister of Oil. So the oil, which is 80% of the government's income, some say 90%, is now directly controlled by the IRGC. So 40 to 50% of the entire economy is then in their hand. Oil is in their hand. They are the only force that is keeping the democratic movement at bay. Khamenei, the leader, is increasingly isolated even amongst the clergy. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out the real force in Iran that is keeping the regime afloat is the IRGC, and they are increasingly becoming more assertive and demanding more and more of political rights, which had traditionally been denied to them.
Dr. Abbas Milani is director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there.
Quote from the news, this is worse than 1992. Back then, at least, we had some help. That was Dr. Lol Mohammed, head of pediatrics at Banadir Hospital in southern Somalia, where the Islamic extremist group al-Shabaab continues to impede Western famine relief efforts to counter a drought that's already killed tens of thousands and threatens 500,000 children with starvation.
Next, launching a democracy movement in the United States. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. By the time I wake up, I'll have an email from AARP asking me to call President Obama and tell him to protect Medicare. That was President Obama joking about his milestone 50th birthday. Rose Garden Party VIPs included Jay-Z, Chris Rock, Tom Hanks, Whoopi Goldberg, Charles Barkley, Stevie Wonder, and Herbie Hancock. Now this.
This land is your land. This land is mine. This land was made for you.
Woody Guthrie's populist anthem, as sung so often by the iconic Pete Seeger, has always been more claim than confirmation. And now more than ever, as economic recovery stalls while the income and influence gap widens between the super rich and practically everyone else. Where is the outrage, some ask? Where is America's Tahrir Square crowded with demonstrators against a system that polls show is increasingly seen headed in the wrong direction?
Some on the left are now looking to Madison, Wisconsin, which at the end of the month plays host to what's being called the nation's first democracy convention, with a wide range of sub-conferences on constitutional reform, national defense, race, the economy, media, and more. Could it lead to a progressive Tea Party, a more aggressive TNT party pushed to civil disobedience? To go inside the convention August 24th to 28th in Madison, we have the chairman and chief organizer, Ben Mansky of the Liberty Tree Foundation, calling in from my hometown of Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to our program.
It's great to be here with you.
Obviously, this convention coming up in Madison was conceived long before last week's nationwide disgust with a political system whose failures became so obvious in the debt ceiling debate. When and how did it start?
Well, the reality is that this crisis, this austerity crisis in which working people have been forced to pay more and more and more and more, working families have been shut out of higher education, shut out of health care, shut out of home ownership, that's been growing for some time. You know, you had to be a little bit asleep to not notice that there were some problems in Washington, D.C. with corporate capture of federal government agencies, corporate capture of Congress, and of the executive branch. And so, you know, I'd say in Seattle 1999, when Americans came together and said, no, we don't want this World Trade Organization setting our economic policies, in some ways, that was the birth of this modern democracy movement. And this democracy convention that we're organizing in Wisconsin is the coming-of-age party for this movement. It's time to get adult about demanding democracy in the United States, making this country live up to its promise.
Can you tell by registration data whether the political paralysis of the last 2 weeks has raised the conference's presumed relevance and appeal?
Yeah, there's no question. We were already at the beginning of the week approaching 700 pre-registrations, expecting just under 1,000 at the convention at the end of the month. This past week, we've up by over 100. And just this morning, I was looking, and we've been having dozens of registrations coming in. So people are looking at what's happening to our economy right now, with an economy where all the rules are written by the very rich and powerful for their own interest, not necessarily in the public interest. And they're saying, we have to do something. They see the convention coming up. They're coming to Wisconsin.
And tell us about the keynote speakers you have lined up.
Absolutely. In some ways, we're looking back, and then we're looking forward. So we're looking back to another seminal event, a document from the Movement for Democracy in the United States, the Port Huron Statement, authored by Tom Hayden. And Tom Hayden is coming to Wisconsin to speak, to talk about our American roots as folks who are really fighting for, again, the best promise of America. And then also Sherry Honklesch, who is unquestionably the leading advocate for poor people's rights in the country, somebody who you will not see on any of the mainstream national news channels. But if you are somebody who is a poor people's advocate, who's involved in advocating for the homeless, for the disenfranchised around the country, you know about Sherry Honklesch. She's coming to talk about how do we move this thing forward, not just those of us who are middle class or who've been making it as working class folks, but also the least among us, the underclass in this country. What happens to them happens to the rest of us.
We mentioned a subconference on constitutional reform, which seems to have you moving along similar lines to the Tea Party and its balanced budget amendment. What sort of reform goals do you see emerging from your convention?
Well, there's no question that within the broader progressive movement, within the labor movement, within the environmental movement, student movement, among veterans' rights advocates, you name it, that there is increased interest in constitutional reform. And it has been, I think, primarily since the Supreme Court handed down that infamous Citizens United decision that said that corporations have constitutional rights, that money is speech, that corporations have a right to buy our elections, essentially to buy our government. And so just almost 2 years ago now, my organization, together with many other organizations around the country, came together and launched the Move to Amend, which listeners can see at movetoamend.org, which is the largest national coalition to overturn Citizens United through constitutional amendments. So we're working to do that, but we also think that there's a lot of other constitutional changes that were envisioned by prior generations that have yet to have been achieved. The Supreme Court says we don't have a right to vote, that we don't have a constitutional right to vote. That's got to be changed if we're going to have meaningful elections in this country.
I have to stop you and ask what you're referring to when you say the Supreme Court says there is no constitutional right to vote.
Absolutely. That was that was part of the holding in Bush v. Gore in 2000. I can tell you, if you look at voting rights law and what the court has come down with in the last generations, to the extent that we have voting rights in the United States, it's a matter of equal protection. In other words, you can't discriminate in terms of voting rights, but the court has not recognized an actual right to vote in the Constitution. So when people say that voting rights have been denied because we don't actually know whether the person who takes office was actually elected, the court says, too bad. They say, too bad. You don't have a constitutional right to vote. You got your opportunity to vote. Doesn't matter whether that vote actually counted or not.
Are you concerned about unwanted changes in the Constitution if passionate activists from the left and right start having at it?
Well, I'm very concerned about unwanted changes in the Constitution, and the reality is some of those changes have already been happening, not at the federal level, but at the state level. Those who, frankly, are a little bit scared of genuine democracy, who are scared of having more participation from more people, have been successful in getting state legislatures to adopt constitutional amendments. And so the organized right is on the march in terms of constitutional reform, whether you're looking at gay rights or you're looking at a tax reform that benefits the wealthy against the rest of us. And it's time that we get into that debate, that we engage, because what the left has been doing for so many years has been sitting on the sidelines while the right's been waging a culture war on us.
Ben Mansky is executive director of the Liberty Tree Foundation and chair of the Democracy Convention, August 24th to 28th in Madison, Wisconsin.
Quote from the news, she smiled to me and said, I love you. That was House Democratic Whip Stoney Hoyer on Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' surprise first return to the House floor since her near-fatal shooting in May to cast a vote for the debt limit deal. Gifford drew a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle.
Next, new twists on security, American style, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. A mounting sense of guilt. That was CNN talk show host Piers Morgan, former editor of a British tabloid, The Mirror, writing in 2006 on how he felt about introducing Paul McCartney to Heather Mills after hearing what Morgan called a heartbreaking message from the former Beatle on Heather's mobile phone. The comment now has prompted calls for Morgan's appearance at another parliamentary hearing on phone hacking in and beyond the Murdoch media empire. Now this.
People can kind of almost be pre-screened, as it were, before they even get to the airport. So we're looking at a lot of evolutions like that over the coming months and years to make that airport experience security effective, but a little less onerous for the passenger.
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano talked with the AP last month as the Transportation Security Administration introduced a new type of less intrusive body scanners for airports, showing only generic figures and suspicious areas rather than the controversial nearly naked views of the last previous machines. But last week, air travel security also took a low-tech twist as Boston's Logan Airport launched an experimental question-and-answer procedure for all passengers.
Last week, too, the Obama administration unveiled a new strategy for countering the increasing threat of homegrown radicalization, as in the case of the Muslim army doctor now facing trial for his fatal shooting rampage at Fort Hood, Texas. But there was immediate concern that the strategy's lack of detail and stress on community involvement, school and local police communication, counseling and employment assistance was more feel-good than sharply focused on preventing terrorism.
To talk more now about the new approach at airports, for your ears only, we're joined by reporter Katie Johnston of the Boston Globe and Boston.com, who wrote about last week's launch. Welcome to our program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
What kind of questions are the TSA folks asking at Logan, and what kind of training did they get to evaluate the answers?
They are asking everybody who comes through. It's just in one terminal right now, and they're asking people, where are you traveling to? How long have you been here? What kind of business are you going on? Just some follow-up questions, just two or three questions. These are TSA officers who've been trained in behavior detection, but they're getting a week of classroom training on top of that and then a week of on-the-job training, which is what they started at Logan Airport this week.
And what are they looking for? What is a suspicious answer?
Well, they're not looking for the answers so much as the reactions to the answers. They're looking for people who are avoiding eye contact or sweating or giving evasive answers or not paying attention. And if they determine that this person seems suspicious or seems like they might be hiding something, they will pull them aside for another round of questioning. And then if they're still not satisfied, once the person goes through security, they will be flagged to get a pat down and have their bag searched and possibly even get the state police involved.
And we gather this test program follows complaints by the American Civil Liberties Union about an earlier form of passenger questioning. How did that differ from the new procedure?
Well, there is a behavior detection program in place at 160 airports around the country in which TSA officers observe people going through security lines and going through the airport kind of from afar, and people that seem a little suspicious to them, like, say, you're wearing a heavy winter coat in the summer buttoned all the way up, or you're sweating or acting strange, they will pull people aside randomly and ask them these kinds of questions. But how this differs is that every single person who's going through the security line in this one terminal so far is getting questioned.
I guess the point is that the ACLU thought that the random selection led to the possibility of profiling, you know, who it was who looked suspicious to a particular TSA guard. This way everybody gets questioned and then there's grounds for further action.
Right. The ACLU is still not crazy about this program, though. They think that even if they're questioning everybody, you still can racially profile people, and they're questioning the authority of the TSA to read people's body language and become experts in this behavior detection in this short amount of time. And they're calling it security theater, which a lot of people have referred to what the TSA is doing.
And the new procedure may remind many people of their experience flying on Israel's El Al airline or any flight from Ben Gurion Airport.
Right. That's the kind of the gold standard for this type of security, and that's what this is based on, basically.
From what you could observe last week, how long did these mini interrogations take? Did they slow down the lines of people trying to get to their flights?
They said they took about 20 seconds, and from what I observed, I saw anywhere from, 20 to 30 seconds to one guy got chatting with the security agent and was there for about a minute, but it was because they kind of engaged in more of a back-and-forth conversation. But it didn't seem to be slowing things down, but the line wasn't especially long. I was there in the middle of the day, which wasn't the busiest, so it was hard to say.
Some people said they worry about becoming flustered under questioning, even if they've done nothing wrong, except maybe lose track of time on vacation in one case. Tell us about that.
Well, one woman I talked to had been in town for a wedding, and she said when the TSA officer asked her how long she'd been here, she couldn't remember because she was on vacation, so she wasn't really thinking. And she said it took her a couple seconds to remember, oh, I've been here for 9 days, but then she felt nervous because she was worried that, oh, because I couldn't remember, maybe they think I'm suspicious. And she clearly had nothing to hide.
Frequent flyers worried more about losing their patience with the same questions again and again.
Right. I talked to one guy who has a job this summer where he's flying every week between Boston and Newark. And he said, once is fine. I don't mind answering a couple of questions. But being asked these same questions every single week is going to get old.
And I gather focusing on these questions may make some people, some TSA people, a little less cognizant of the boarding passes that people are carrying, you told me.
Yes, I did have a reader write in and say that she and her sister were traveling through Logan. This was actually before the questioning started. This was in early July. And she and her sister were traveling through Logan to Cancun. And she said they looked nothing alike. One was tall and thin. The other was short and round, different last names. But they had inadvertently switched boarding passes. But they made it all the way through security, according to what she said, and didn't realize they had different tickets until they were about ready to board the plane. And they couldn't believe it when they heard about all this added layer of security. They thought, well, they aren't even catching the fact that we had the completely wrong boarding passes. So that's a little discouraging.
So what's the plan for how long the new procedure will be tested at Logan, and where will it go from there?
It's a 60-day pilot program, and then they will evaluate it and see if they want to spread it to more airports and make it a nationwide policy.
And what level of electronic scanning do they use at Logan? Generic body outlines, something else?
They don't have the generic software yet. They still have the first generation, so to speak, of the software where you see an image of the person's actual naked body. It's blurred slightly, and you can't really see the face, but it's the actual person's body.
Katie Johnston is a reporter for the Boston Globe and Boston.com.
Quote from the news, then went home to clean and organize. That was Levi Aaron in a chilling written account of how he kidnapped, killed, and dismembered 8-year-old Libby Kelsey from his own Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn. Aaron was found competent to stand trial, though his lawyers are still considering an insanity defense.
Next, from hot rods to hot tickets on Broadway and a new CD, Tom Wopat for Your Ears Only. We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. With this quote from the news, I get chills thinking about it. That was Nick Walenda, a 32-year-old seventh-generation circus performer, on his determination to walk 1,800 feet across Niagara Falls on a 2-inch diameter steel cable. But some local officials, especially on the Canadian side, were dubious about granting permission to revive the stunting of an earlier era. Now this.
That's life. That's what people say. Up in April, down in May. I know I can change that tune when I'm back on top in June.
Despite the lyrics he sells so well, actor and singer Tom Wopat has had far more ups and downs in his career to date. After charming TV audiences in the 1970s as the freewheeling Luke on Dukes of Hazzard, Wopat wheeled onto Broadway, where he made his debut in Cy Coleman's I Love My Wife. Later, Coleman's Tony Award-winning City of Angels, a revival of the classic Guys and Dolls, and a Tony nomination as Master Marksman Frank Butler in a revival of Annie Get Your Gun, opposite Bernadette Peters. This year, he has returned to the stage in the new musical adaptation of the movie Catch Me If You Can.
Wopat is also a successful recording artist with 8 albums so far, the newest one being Consider It Swung, including the Sinatra classic we just sampled. His previous albums include A Little Bit Closer to Love, Don't Look Back, The Still of the Night, and Dissertation on the State of Bliss, featuring the music of Harold Arlen. And for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to have Tom Wopat on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You grew up in a little town called Lodi, Wisconsin. Was music and performing part of your early life?
Absolutely. I went to a little public school in Lodi, and in those days, in the 50s and 60s, the public education in Wisconsin was pretty exceptional. So we were able to do everything. We had band, chorus, and I did all the sports, and it was... Music was always a big part of things.
How did you get your actual start in show business?
I came to New York in 77 and got an agent. And then I had my first thing was an off-Broadway show called The Bistro Car and the CNR. I left that to do a regional production, this is 78, of Robert Bridegroom. I came back to Broadway to do I Love My Wife. And then a couple months after that, I got cast in Dukes.
Of course, audiences will always remember you leaping into that blazing orange General Lee, driving down dirt roads in Dukes of Hazzard. Do you have a favorite episode or memory of filming that series?
There's quite a few episodes that were awful lot of fun. I actually ended up directing half a dozen of them. And one of them is called the Boar's Nest Bears, where it's a basketball team instead of a softball team. But we pretty much stole the script otherwise. Ghost of General Lee was another great, great episode.
Did you ever think it would become such an iconic TV hit?
You know, kind of figured out early on that it struck a nerve. I don't know that I would think that 35 years later I'd still be talking about it.
You've starred in so many Broadway productions, those we mentioned, as well as A Catered Affair, for which you received your second Tony nomination. Which has been your favorite to perform?
I would have to say that Annie Get Your Gun was probably the acme, just because of being able to work with Bernadette 8 times a week. Kind of, I think, one of our real iconic stage actresses, and just a really fine and generous performer. I enjoyed that probably the most. Glengarry Glen Ross is probably the tightest piece that I ever worked on. That's an amazing play, and we had an amazing cast for that.
And are there Broadway roles you're still longing to try?
The ones that I'd really love to do, I'm getting a little long in the tooth for, so... it's hard to say that'll happen. There's other new stuff in the pipeline. There's a show called Hands on a Hard Body that I just did a workshop of. That's actually about a contest in Texas of winning a pickup truck. That's what the hard body is. Then there's also a Bruce Hornsby musical that I've worked on a couple of times. Those are both in the line.
In addition to your stage career, you have recorded 8 albums, and musically you shift among rock and country and classic pop standards. Is one of those genres a personal favorite, the ruler of your iPod?
Well, you know, I would have to say kind of these days it's a mix between the classic rock and jazz. I did country for a while, and I actually lived in Nashville for several years, and I enjoyed that group of people a great deal. It's probably not my best genre to sing in. I think this kind of mix, like on Consider It Swung, where it's basically like 40% standards, 40% pop tunes, pop standards, and then a couple of original tunes. I think that's kind of what our mix is when we do live stuff.
How and why did you choose the particular songs for this album?
You know, at this point in my career, I kind of record what I want to record. there were a couple of suggestions in there from Dave Fink, the bass player who helped, who produced the record. But primarily, these were my choices. And, you know, having done the different types of singing that I've done over the last 40 years, it just kind of all works together. And I think if you have a consistent instrumentation and a kind of a consistent idea arrangement-wise, that you can put a, you know, a Delbert McClinton tune next to a Gershwin tune, next to a Steely Dan song, next to Ode to Billy Joe. You know, it seems to work. And people seem to be entertained by it. It's a little bit off the beaten track as far as the standards record goes. But I like it, and people seem to respond to it.
Actor-singer Tom Wopat currently stars in Catch Me If You Can. His latest CD is Consider It Swung, including this.
Ride the pink pony, let the spinning wheel ride.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Jupiter holds the history of the solar system. That was Scott Bolton, principal investigator for the Juno mission, a spacecraft that successfully launched Friday on a 5-year mission to the largest planet orbiting our sun to help answer questions about the solar system's origins.
For Your Ears Only is online at iTunes News and Politics or podcastbunker.com. To make a tax-deductible donation, please email david.ears.only@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Paul Ruest at Argo Studios. With intern Gene Moon, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our program is a production of the nonprofit Gatewave Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities, supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week last year, we reported on a controversial nomination to the Supreme Court and some legal controversies coming to the court as well from our August 8, 2010 broadcast, hosted by David and Isaac Davey Aronson.
They've gotten a sense of her formidable intelligence, her rich understanding of our Constitution, her commitment to the rule of law, and her excellent and occasionally irreverent sense of humor.
She gives every indication of someone who believes that it is within her role and prerogative as a justice to basically make the law rather than to enforce the law as written.
Going to the chapel and we're going to get married. Going to the chapel and we're going to get married.
We're not wimps and we're not going to roll over and play dead when the issue is truth.
Guess what's coming to the Supreme Court? For sure, a third female associate justice, Elena Kagan, whose long-predicted confirmation last week, as praised by President Obama, did not stop the criticism of conservatives like Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas. And taking a long step closer to the high court was the debate over gay marriage, after a federal district judge in California ruled against the ban on it in the state, passed by a popular referendum known as Proposition 8. While gay rights advocates celebrated in San Francisco, the Reverend Jim Garlow in San Diego promised the AP there would be an appeal.
The court case was won by a bipartisan team of top attorneys, Democrat David Boies and conservative Republican Ted Olson, but the verdict assured that same-sex marriage would probably be a divisive hot-button social issue in the campaigns of 2010 and 2012, even though some Republicans worried that taking it up would turn off moderates and distract from a far stronger economic case against the president and his Democratic congressional majority.
And there were other important legal developments during the week. In Virginia, another federal judge turned down a Justice Department attempt to block legal action by one of more than a dozen state attorneys general against administration-backed health care reform legislation. And two civil rights groups took legal action to keep al-Qaeda-linked Imam Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen, off an intelligence capture or kill list before he has even been officially charged with a crime. To discuss these and related matters, we have David Brown, editor-in-chief of the National Law Journal, back again for your ears only. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We talked earlier about Kagan's confirmation hearings. Any surprises in the final debate and the vote that clears her for the court?
Not really. I think it's been clear for a while that the Democrats had the votes here to block any filibuster attempt, and that absent a scandal, Kagan would sit on the court. And I think last week you saw Republican senators sounding themes they've been hitting since the committee hearings on the nomination, questioning Kagan's experience and whether she would be a liberal activist on the bench. So no real surprises there.
Kagan replaces a retiring liberal on the court, so no immediate shift in the left-right balance, although we don't know if she's actually as liberal as the justice she's replacing. But what impact do you expect from her presence on the bench in the short run?
I think initially it's going to be a matter of a change of style more than anything else and how the justices relate to each other. The court is not as big as Congress or the executive branch. It's a small and insular institution, and every new justice changes the chemistry and collaborations there. I think the primary thing for Kagan right away is that she's going to be very busy. The court typically gets 2,000 petitions or so over the summer, so at first she'll just have a lot of work on her plate.
Let's turn to the gay marriage case. Proponents thought U.S. District Court Chief Judge Vaughn Walker did a great job defining Proposition 8 as the unreasonable enshrinement of prejudice against same-sex couples without any proper state interest, and therefore a violation of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Conservative critics said Walker's legal reasoning was flawed and would easily be overturned. What's your view?
Well, from the way I and I think some of my colleagues read it, Judge Walker didn't look like he felt he had to stretch all that far to make this decision. He relied upon a couple of key Supreme Court precedents on gay rights issues and state Supreme Court opinions in California and Iowa. I think what's far more interesting in this opinion to me is this sort of remarkable 55 pages of findings of fact, which attempted to, it seems, demolish not just the arguments about California's gay marriage ban, but also to poke holes in discriminatory arguments about gay people in general. It was a real message, I think, to litigants that they need to really prove themselves if they're going to pass muster in the federal courts on this issue.
How big a hurdle for the appeal by proponents of Prop 8 is the fact that their lawyers presented so few witnesses and so little evidence that same-sex marriage was a serious threat the state could properly counter? Do they get another chance to make a stronger factual case?
I'm not sure. I mean, Judge Walker actually went through something like 80 factual findings in his opinion, I believe, and talking about the evidence presented during this case occupied much of his decision. So I don't know how many more factual elements there are to be addressed, frankly. I'm going to guess that the focus at the appellate level is going to be on whether Walker erred in the way he conducted this trial, and more importantly, whether his findings on equal protection and due process were too broad given the precedents involved.
How relevant is Supreme Court precedent on laws outlawing interracial marriage or consensual homosexual practices?
Gay marriage supporters are certainly going to be citing those rulings, as well as a third Supreme Court precedent that overturned a Colorado law that made it illegal to treat gay men and lesbians as a protected class. Two of those three cases that we're talking about were authored by Justice Anthony Kennedy. So all eyes are going to be on him if this does indeed make it to the Supreme Court, which, by the way, I'm not sure is a given. Assuming, though, it does get to the court, Kennedy could join the court's liberals, and you might see a 5-4 majority there. But it's dangerous to assume that. One thing to remember is that his opinion in the Texas anti-gay sodomy law case didn't necessarily extend to recognition of same-sex relationships. So both sides are going to have to work hard for his vote, I think, if the case comes to court.
While we're talking about the 14th Amendment, some Republicans are talking about amending it so that babies born to illegal immigrants here aren't automatically U.S. citizens. What prospects do you see for that?
I think that's going to have a tough road ahead. That's going to be challenged right away in the lower courts, and it could be years before that kind of law is actually on the books, if it ever is at all. And decisions like the ones that we're talking about actually in the gay rights cases could also be used in this context to strike down anything that tackled immigration as well.
Moving on, were you surprised that the Justice Department lost its effort to stop legal action against health care reform legislation? And does that loss tell us anything about how the merits of the case against the new law may be judged, especially the mandate for purchase of individual health insurance?
I think surprise may not be the right word. Inevitable is more like it, because there's so many challenges out there. I mean, right now there are three cases in the federal courts on this legislation, and in this particular instance, Virginia is arguing that citizens of the state have the right not to buy health insurance if they don't want to. They cleared a very significant first hurdle this week because the judge said that they had the right to bring the case, that it had standing. But they haven't argued the case on its merits yet, so it's too soon to tell how far the judge is going to go. The judge seems interested, though, and he said that no court has squarely addressed the issue of whether Congress has the power to regulate a citizen's decision not to participate in interstate commerce.
Finally, what was your reaction to the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights agreeing to argue against the government's authority to assassinate an American citizen without ever putting him on trial for his connection with several recent terrorism cases?
What's interesting here to me is that the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights are actually going to an even more basic level before they even get to the argument about the authority for these so-called targeted killings. Federal law says that if a lawyer wants to represent someone identified as a specially designated global terrorist, I think is the term, they have to get a special license from the government to do so. And the groups are saying that rule is unconstitutional. The government, interestingly enough, gave them that license last week, but ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights are going to go ahead and fight that issue as well. So even before we get to the underlying issue, this is a fight that's going to be heavily engaged and going to be going on for quite a while.
David Brown is editor-in-chief of the National Law Journal.
Coming to the court from our August 8th, 2010 broadcast. In the years since, conservatives have made repeated requests for administration files they hope will show Kagan so involved in health care reform that she would have to recuse herself from the case. So far, none have. Last week in the Prop 8 case, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals asked the state Supreme Court to decide if California law gives gay marriage opponents, quote, the authority to assert the state's interests, unquote, since California's governor and attorney general refused to do so, and New York joined the list of states that recognize such marriages. Last month, U.S. and Yemeni officials said American-born al-Qaeda cleric Anwar al-Awlaki had narrowly survived yet another drone strike. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week.